Hey, baby. I know you need a little cash to get you through the night. So why don't you just come upstairs and I'll give you an advance payday loan. Or even a subprime. Oh, don't bother to read the fine print. You don't want to spoil the mood by discovering the interest rate. Don't you know that I'm trying to seduce you? Don't you know that you're my bitch?
Okay, so I am here with Gary Rivlin, who is most recently the author of Broke USA. Gary, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I wanted to first of all start off with a very general question. The common conservative defense for high interest lending is generally that it permits borrowers to obtain money. There is no other option. Senator Phil Graham's insistence, as you quote in the book, is, "I look to subprime lending and I see the American dream in action." You have Willie Green, the former NFL player, who is the only guy who appears in that 60 Minutes segment, grew up in poverty and is now has 10 Advance America chains in this. But on the other hand, if we are talking about an industry that has no other alternative, why should the subprime industry be blamed for providing a service that government or the private industry couldn't? I mean, where is the borrower's responsibility?
Right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with businesses in inner city communities or in crumbling working class communities providing loans. The question is, how much do they charge and their behavior, in essence? I mean, payday lending, I actually started, just for people who are listening, a payday loan is a short-term loan, typically of 2 weeks, against a person's next paycheck, Social Security check, whatever regular check they have coming in. And I started off thinking, like, well, what do you do if you don't have a rich uncle, if you just can't put it on a credit card, or a credit card has been its own poison in your life, and you want to avoid that? And really, by the end of, it was kind of an 18 months on the economic fringes, you know, the issue was the aggressiveness with which they're selling this product. It's not just this emergency product available when you need it. They're knocking on your door. They're ringing your phone. They're providing inducements so you use it more and more and more and more. So, you know, criticism one would be, for lack of a better word, the behavior of these industries. And then a second point is, in the industry, it's called risk-based pricing. It makes a lot of sense on paper, right? If I have a good credit score, I'm a better risk, so they're going to charge me less interest for a loan. The issue is how much more they're charging people. To me, it's opportunity-based pricing, an opportunity to charge somebody who has no other options, an exorbitant fee. Really, when you get down to it, it's the profits the payday lenders over the years have made off their customers versus the profits someone going to a regular bank, a commercial bank, the profits that bank is making. The payday lenders until recently were making three times the profit off the single mom with two kids struggling to get by on $20,000 a year. That's the problem to me. It's not that they're in these neighborhoods. It's just that they're making far, far, far more money off the downtrodden customer than they are over the prosperous customer.
But how do you answer, say, a conservative who would say to you, well, it is the borrower's responsibility to check the AVR, to check the terms, to not fall for those hidden costs, to look at the paperwork closely? How do you answer that? I mean, they would call someone who would sign up for these things foolish. In fact, Willie Green even said, "My wife has a master's in economics," to you.
Right, yeah. Right. Willie Green, the payday lender,
yeah, exactly.
when he was on 60 Minutes.
Oh, he was on 60 Minutes, I'm sorry, yeah.
Scott Paley.
That's his justification.
Scott Paley, yeah. You know, said, well, would your wife take out a payday loan? Or what would you think if your wife took out a payday loan? And he responded, essentially, she's too smart for that.
Yeah.
She has a master's in accounting. You know what? I agree with that criticism that when you sign for a loan, a payday loan, a subprime mortgage, yes, you have responsibility. The problem, I probably would agree with conservatives on another issue. The issue really is financial education. The issue is that all of us, and we're not just talking about the working poor, which I tend to focus in on the book, but the middle class, upper middle class, probably a lot of wealthy people, a lot of people with their college educations and then masters, you know, don't really know that much about finance. So I do think in this country there's a general problem. So, yes, when you go into a payday loan shop, the APR is typically posted, the fee you're going to pay is posted, and so there's not that unfairness that I know we saw with a lot of subprime mortgage lending. You see, that's a different issue. There was a lot of fraud there. There was a lot of bait and switch. There was a lot of hidden fees. You can't say that about pawnbrokers. You can't say that about payday lenders. You can't say that about rent-to-own. They are open in what they charge. I guess the criticism on the other side, what one would say to the conservatives, is that you've got a lot of trapped borrowers and you're charging them way too much. And I return to the point I just made about kind of this moral issue, like, wow, so you're making greater profit off, you know, the woman working as a chambermaid at the local Holiday Inn than you are over the white collar professional fellow, you know, working for a bank. I mean, that's more of, you know, where I have my criticisms. I mean, I wouldn't outlaw all these businesses.
You mentioned education as a remedy to someone who is so desperate for a payday loan. But when you are caught within the throes of poverty and you need the money now, you're not exactly going to go to some education course or anything like that. So I must say, it would seem to me that the working stiff is going to say, education, I got a car that's broken down. I need the money now.
Right. No, fair enough. I guess what I meant by education is this notion of like, well, payday lending might satisfy my immediate need, but you know, the person who's so desperate for $300 today that they're willing to pay a $45 fee, if not more in some states, and then they're going to owe $345 in 2 weeks. Well, how are they going to have that extra $345? There's a woman in Dayton I love quoting, a payday loan helps you bridge a gap. The problem is the gap keeps getting wider and wider. So that's what I mean more of education, because the truth is that you could have in big screaming letters, and in fact some stores do, that if you take out this loan, you're paying an effective annual interest rate of 391%. But you are so desperate, I mean, I've heard payday customers say this, you're so desperate for that money that you don't care. You just want that $300 and you worry about how to pay it back in 2 weeks. So you bring up regulation. You know, a couple of ideas that are out there are, A, to cap the rates. The payday lenders say, you cap us at 36% rather than 400%, you're going to put us out of business, and we can talk about that. Another regulation that I find really intriguing is to limit the number of payday loans a person can take. I mean, one place I would start personally is limiting people to a single payday loan at once, where these things get really, really dangerous and very expensive, is that when a person, it comes time for them to pay back the $345, they don't have it. So they go to a store across the street and borrow $350 from them, then they owe that store, but then they have to pay them back in 2 weeks. And, you know, it's this cycle, and people end up owing two or three or four stores at once, and you're not getting out of that kind of trap when you make $25,000 a year. So, you know, regulation one, I would say one loan at a time. And by the way, I mean, that's the law in Florida. This exists. It's just, it's very rare. And another idea was actually just floated in the Senate, but didn't get anywhere, to limit people to X number of payday loans a year. The proposal I'm talking about was six. And that number made sense to me because, again, the payday lenders defend this as saying this is an emergency product. You said it yourself. Your car's broken down. You need to fix it. It seems to me that once you're going over six payday loans a year, this is no longer an emergency product. This is a very expensive way to balance your checkbook every month.
Yeah. Let's shift to the instant tax refund. Beneficial Finance, H&R Block, numerous imitators built up their businesses with a refund anticipation loan.
Right.
And you have hidden charges of tax preparation. You have a ridiculous level of interest. But if working people are so desperate, again, to get that money, they can't wait the 2 to 3 weeks
right.
for the IRS to send them the check.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm wondering if what we're talking about here is government inefficiency, the inability to bridge the gap and have the IRS instantly get the money into the hands of these people. These people need their money now. They want their money now. Private industry, it could be argued,
right.
is only filling in a niche market here.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And just to kind of provide context, it's, in a way, these instant tax mills is the most interesting of all these poverty businesses I'm writing about because it's so counterintuitive. Let's put tax preparation stores in neighborhoods where the household income is below $30,000. And you think like, okay, so you're going to go to neighborhoods where people don't have much money. But, you know, once a year, the working poor briefly feel rich, and that's tax time because of the Earned Income Tax Credit, federal poverty program dating back to the Nixon era. People get 2-3 months worth of salary if they have kids as a tax refund. And, you know, you can imagine that a lot of people that are, you know, they've got the landlord hounding them because they're a month or two late on their rent, or they owe the credit card company, or the gas company. Just they've been putting off whatever, buying a new bed for the kids, for the kid. And so, yes, they are definitely providing a service. I come back to how much they're charging. The good news here is because of the consumer advocates, the rates that the lenders are charging, because these are essentially loans against the refunds you're going to get in two or three weeks. And so you've got very big banks, JP Morgan Chase, HSBC, one of the biggest banks on the planet based in London. They're two of the biggest players. They are the two biggest players in this world. And because of pressure, they've reduced their rates from the effective interest rate of 100, 200% to down more than 60%. 100%, but as you point out, in a way, that's not even the way the working poor are getting hit the hardest. You might pay $100 to get your refund tomorrow rather than in 2 or 3 weeks. It's the preparation fee these places are charging. I went to my own tax prep person and said, like, well, if I came in and just had a pretty simple form to fill out, she's, you know, what would you charge me? She would charge me a half, if not a third, of what these places. They're charging like $300 or so per form, and that doesn't include the refund anticipation loan fees. And so these businesses are collecting about $1 billion all told in these refund anticipation loan fees and interest rates. And on top of that, they're collecting about $3 billion in tax prep. And so should there be a law against that? I don't know. We can't regulate everything out of existence, but it seems to me that they're really ripping people off.
Why did this augment itself so much? I mean, it started off, presumably, with innocuous intentions. Many of the people who run these particular outlets view themselves as philanthropists, as helping the community.
Right.
But now, as you cite in the book, 2006, Chi-Chi Wu and Jean Ann Fox discovered that more than 12 million Americans spent $1.24 billion just on the interest and fees because of this problem.
Right.
How did we get to such a remarkable cost that was put into the hands of private industries?
Right.
Was it simply a tale of inevitable escalation, a chain effect, greed?
Right. I mean, you started to give the argument for the instant tax people, who, in fact, you correctly said it, they see themselves as noble. We're in communities hiring people. I mean, it's only a few months a year, but we're hiring people, we're paying rents. There's some commerce in communities where there isn't much commerce. They feel like they're really providing a service. I mean, people are desperate for money. And when you ask about the high fees, what they say is like, well, doesn't the, you know, Louis Ices place that's open 3 months a year, don't they charge a lot, you know, for a cup of ices?
Yeah.
Because they have to pay for the rent for the whole year for the place that's just open only for a few months. But to get to your bigger question, I feel like the bottom 40%, I feel like the real issue is that the bottom 40% in this country over the last decade or two have seen stagnating wages, that real wages adjusted for inflation have fallen while rent, healthcare, gas prices, all sorts of expenses have just soared. And so there's more and more pressure on those on the bottom of the economic pyramid. And these businesses are coming in. Are they feasting on people's misery? Are they providing us? Are they financial angels providing a service to the desperate? I mean, in a way, that's the book. I mean, that's the frames of the two sides that frame the entire book. And you know, I don't think it's as easy as saying, as the consumer critics say, that you know these folks are vultures that should be outlawed tomorrow. But I also don't think they're noble human beings. I mean, they want to make money, and they're making a lot of money. And the question is, what role does government have, if any, in moderating that transaction?
But as you also point out in the book, the average check cashing center generally has a staff of one or two.
Petty lender.
Yeah, exactly. And you're dealing with a situation in which it's franchised, and the great overseer is going to be collecting most of this particular revenue. And it's very hard for some of these people who work second jobs to maintain these businesses. And so, therefore, you could regulate them, you could ask for lower interest, but on the other hand, they're going to come back and say to you, well, we're barely surviving as it is because of this arrangement.
Right. I mean, you mentioned Chi-Chi Wu and Jinan Fox before. One law they would like to see initiated is you cannot do a refund anticipation loan against the earned income tax credit. Their argument is this is you know, maybe the one single most effective anti-poverty program we have. Is the incentives are right. If you work and make money and have kids, we'll give you a refund. So it's relatively low cost. There isn't some huge bureaucracy overseeing. It's just, you know, it's built into the refund. So, you know, their argument is it's a 40-some-odd billion-dollar-a-year program, and we're seeing a leakage of, you know, maybe $1 billion a year. The point that the tax preparers make is that these stores don't make as much as you think they do. I mean, this is generally true for a lot of these poverty businesses, that these stores are making $20,000 a year. That's true more or less for the payday lenders. You know, each individual store is, you know, after-tax profit of $20,000. You know, the tax prep stores are making around that much. But the game becomes, therefore, let's just not just have one store.
Yeah.
Let's have 20. Let's have 200. Let's have 2,000. And suddenly you see people are making huge, huge profits. I mean, that was some of the shock for me in doing this book, that, you know, there's always been a poverty industry. Pawnbroking goes back to the first time someone, you know, said, hey, if I give you my ring, will you give me some money temporarily? You know, check cashers back to at least the 1930s in this country. I think the change is the amount of money people are making off of these businesses, that, you know, I could start ticking off the names for you of people who have made tens of millions of dollars in the poverty business, hundreds of millions of dollars in the poverty business. So, you know, the cry of poverty rings empty to my ear, given that the people I spoke to who were making that argument had chains of 1,000 of these stores.
Yeah. I wanted to get into the marketing. You talked with Chris Browning, a former manager of a Check and Go in Ohio.
That's a payday lender. So,
yes, yeah. Yes. And who was fired because she was required by the higher-ups to upsell, to lend money to anybody who walked through the door. Yet Jared Davis, the head, denied that there was any upselling policy in place. He did reveal to you that Check and Go's practice was to contact customers who hadn't returned in 60 days. But I'm wondering, aside from this Chris Browning interview, did you find any specific evidence of upselling within these outlets?
Right. And just so people know, so upselling is this idea that you come into a payday lender and ask for $200, but you have enough of a take-home pay to qualify for, let's say, $500. And so, as Chris Browning told it, she was required by the rules of Check and Go, big payday lending chain, to no less than three times remind somebody, you know, you could have $500. Oh, that's okay. And she's printing out the paperwork. Well, you see, it says right here you qualify for $500. To answer your specific question, no, I didn't actually find any evidence from anyone else. Though I did talk to more former payday lenders than are in the book. I was scared it was going to start sounding repetitive. If every person I spoke to, every victim, every entrepreneur, every former employee, you know, if I, you know, just... I didn't feel obliged to give everyone's story, but there was a sameness to the stories of the people who used to work in payday stores, and that's the pressure they felt to increase their loan volume. You know, pretty much every payday lending store always has some kind of come on going that $20 off your next payday loan if you bring in a family member, a friend, a workmate. $20 free gas card, some kind of thing, you know, to recruit you to bring in. The other thing you mentioned that Chris Browning talked about is the computer every morning would spit out the names of people who have not been in the store in 60 days. That's not a universal policy in the payday world, but Check and Go is hardly the only chain to use a method like that. And I come back to like, wait a second. So this is an emergency loan product available for when people really, really need it, but you're calling people up and trying to induce them to come in? I mean, everyone always needs a little bit of money, and that's, to me, again, when you know a line was crossed. Check and Go says, well, don't you get a reminder from the dentist? They have an appointment, and it's like, well, that's because it's time for you to have your teeth cleaning or whatever. It's not time, any time for your emergency loan, so... I feel like that's one area where, you know, the industry has gone overboard. And not the only. We could get into that if you want, but there's, you know, all sorts of raffles and loyalty programs like the airlines have. Anything to convince the customer who comes in once a month to come in once a week.
Yeah. The equivalent of the 10 coffees, get the next one free card. Yeah.
Right. Actually, I sat in on a... I attended the Check Cashers Convention in 2008, and I sat in on a breakout session on increasing revenues. And, you know, the cash three checks, get the fourth one free was one of the ideas. This guy who was leading it, he had worked for several of the big chains and was sharing with smaller operators some of the tricks of the trade. And as he put it, you know, these are people who are not used to getting anything for free.
Yeah.
And it's probably true. It probably is a little bit more effective among the working poor that get something free than even is among kind of your average consumer.
On the other hand, going back to the thin profit margin, which we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. I mean, these businesses do have to stay alive by any means necessary, it might mm-hmm. be argued. So the question is what would be the acceptable ethical level of marketing needed to run one of these particular businesses? Or is the very practice by way of the interest just unethical, in your view?
Okay, there's a lot in that. There's a lot in that question. You know, I mean, I try to avoid, like, should this be outlawed? Just like a political reporter wouldn't, if you asked them, you know, did you vote for McCain or Obama? It's like, you know, just let my words speak for myself on kind of that, should this be outlawed, you know, kind of thing. But I sure, these businesses need to advertise. They need to let people know they're there. To me, it's the kind of stuff, the little tricks of the trade, they use to get people to use what to me is potentially a very dangerous financial product. You know, there are rules for the way you could sell cigarettes or alcohol or, you know, pharmaceuticals in this country. I would say that there should be, I mean, there are rules that guide the making of a toaster, a $20 toaster. I'm stealing a line from Elizabeth Warren right there, consumer advocate. But I think there should be rules guiding these financial products because they could destroy you financially. They could bankrupt you. They could have you living in turmoil, you know, for months, if not years. I mean, we saw that with the subprime mortgage lending, and even though we're talking with a payday loan of $300 or $500 rather than a mortgage of $100,000, $300,000, they still could do damage, and I do think they should be treated differently than just any old product.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk about North Carolina and Georgia, which have banned payday loans. You bring up the Federal Reserve 2008 study by Donald Morgan. He claimed that these two states have bounced more checks and filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy at a higher rate than the states that still permit payday loans. You note some of the opposition to this Morgan study. But you don't actually bring up one aspect of the study, which I found quite interesting. In 2003...
Wait, let me get this right. You actually... researching for this, you went and read the study.
I went and looked at the study, yes.
Wow, wow.
Yes. But in 2003...
You gotta get out of the Motel 6 one.
Well, hey, yeah, I do this. So 2003, Hawaii has the payday loan limits increased from $300 to $600. And then you have borrowers' problems with lenders declining, being resolved in a month as opposed to several months, and the rate of bankruptcy declining.
Huh.
So what of these Hawaii results? Does this suggest that maybe payday loans, even for all of their faults that we're discussing here, they can possibly be beneficial to the state's economy? Or
you had me until you said beneficial to the state's economy.
Well, I mean, the Hawaii thing, there were good positive results even when they went up.
Right, right, the limits. Right. Though I'll point out that most of those profits are going to chains that are based in Tennessee, South Carolina, Ohio. So most of the profits there are leaving the state. But, you know, let me take this on by kind of getting to a bigger point. We could get in the weeds and debate, you know, the flaws, the supposed flaws in the Morgan study or whatever. But I think he makes overall a good point that... if you kick the payday lenders out, I think it's inevitable that we're going to have more bounce check fees. I think it's inevitable that we'll have more late credit cards and more utility turnoffs because people don't have, you know, this emergency loan available to them. And, you know, the payday lenders make a legitimate point when they say that there are circumstances where, despite the high rates they charge, it makes economic sense to take out a payday loan.
Yeah.
If you could borrow $200 for a $30 fee and avoid a couple of bounced check fees, you're ahead of the game. The problem is that even the payday lending industry says that the typical borrower takes 4 or 5 or 6 two-week periods to pay the loan back. And suddenly, that's not a $30 you're paying on your $200, that's $150, $180, maybe more that you're paying, and suddenly the economics get skewered. So I'm not saying there aren't circumstances where a payday loan is a bad... I'm not saying that right. There are circumstances where a payday loan is a good alternative. The problem is 2 weeks later when you have to pay it back, suddenly... what's your good alternative?
So what you're suggesting then, perhaps, what might be the best resolution to for all happy mediums here is perhaps just a heavy regulated payday loan. You can't have an all-or-nothing proposition, it seems, based off of the Morgan study and based off of the draconian interest rates.
Well, one thing that Florida has done, here's a sentence that you don't hear very often. They've been very progressive, Florida, on this issue. I'm not sure what the consumer advocates love this, but they've capped the rate at 10% of the fee. So that's, you know, $10 in every $100 borrowed, which works out to a annual interest rate more like 250% rather than 400%. As I mentioned earlier, they limit you to one loan at a time. So at least you don't have people owing 3, 4, 5 at once. They keep a database. I mean, if you limit people to one loan, you need to monitor this. And they keep a database. So there's a rich source of data that helps us understand what's going on. And, you know, you could bring up the Hawaii study. I'll counter with, you know, Florida and a few other states that do monitor the activity of payday customers. And they found, this is pretty consistent across the four, that one in every 5 customers is taking out 20 or more payday loans a year. So suddenly this effective interest rate of $400% becomes the actual interest rate. I mean, if you're taking out 20 payday loans a year, that's pretty much a loan every 2 weeks. And so you've got a couple of million people a year in this country who are essentially paying 400% for their money to put it into dollars and cents. For that $500 loan, they're paying $2,000 in fees for the year. So it's the trap that a payday loan becomes that I focus in on.
I wanted to talk about Martin Eakes, the man behind Self-Help and the Center for Responsible Lending. He offers a more reasonable APR through his credit union. His crusading has helped to initiate reform in numerous states. High interest loans, mortgage premium penalties, he's been on it. His opponents, they point to his self-interest, though, in creating caps that are uniquely beneficial to self-help. I want to address this. I mean, what are the credit card's interest fees on overdrafts? Just to give you an example, if a consumer gets a hit, the median overdraft fee is about $27 if you get a $20 debit card transaction. They repay the charge in 2 weeks, and according to the FDIC, that's a 3,250% APR that far outshines that 33 per $100 cap in Indiana, which that works out to 858% on a two-week loan. So I'm wondering if credit unions are in some way just as problematic, or perhaps even more problematic on the overdraft charge than payday lenders when we consider this.
Right. You're giving the argument that the payday lenders make that I was starting to make myself before, that, you know, you could look at our 400% interest rate, but go start doing the math, as you just did, on bounce checks or late credit card fees. And again, that's a legitimate point. I mean, Martin Eakes is one of the main characters in my book. He's just a really interesting, quirky fellow. A few fun facts. He claims he's never had a sip of alcohol in his life. He testifies all the time before Congress, gives speeches. He owns a single suit to save money. His wife cuts his hair. My favorite quote from him is, half the people I know would take a bullet from me and the other half would fire the pistol. And that's accurate. I mean, he's really been out there as a leading crusader, if not the leading crusader, against subprime mortgage abuse, against the payday lenders, against some of the more abusive policies by credit card companies.
And the people who work for him have salary caps as well. It's not exactly a lucrative prospect to work for this company.
The payday lenders and others try to tar Martin Eakes, but he's a little bit Ralph Naderish in that way. He's hard to tar. I mean, there's a rule with him, his credit union, that no one can be paid more than three times more than the lowest paid employee. Yeah. And that means that this guy who runs essentially a billion-dollar operation, he's got a lot of, they've done a lot of home loans, is getting paid $69,000 a year. I guess everybody roots for the receptionist to get a raise
Of that MacArthur money was disseminated around. But you have to make some kind of money. And as we have determined with this overdraft situation, that's quite an interest.
Right. Well, a few things. One way you misspoke is that his credit union doesn't offer payday loans. One of his colleagues in North Carolina, the big North Carolina credit union for teachers and state employees, they offer a payday loan with an effective annual interest rate of 12%. I mean, 12% versus the 400%. And I met with the fellow who runs that credit union, and he called it the single most profitable loan they offer. But getting back to the criticism they level at Martin Eakes, that isn't he just a competitor? Isn't he just fighting the payday loan industry because he's looking out for the bottom line of his own credit union? Well, one problem with that is it was in 2001 that Martin Eakes and others in North Carolina kicked the payday lenders out of the state. Martin Eakes's credit union, you're only eligible to participate if you live in North Carolina.
Yeah.
So he won the fight in 2001. Why is he still fighting the payday lenders across the country, given that his bottom line is only affected in North Carolina? I find that the argument, that I heard it from every payday lender I met with, that Martin Eakes is just a competitor. It's just very specious. He's a crusader. He might see the world in black and white, where these things should be outlawed, period. But I think he's genuine in his criticism. I don't think it has anything to do with his credit union. His credit union doesn't even offer credit cards to, rack up the late fees.
But how much does he charge for overdraft fees?
$20. $20. I was really curious about that question too. Right? It's funny.
I mean, that's just, you know, you're still dealing with pretty substantial APR. I mean, when does that $20 kick in?
Yeah, the problem with APRs on a bounced check is it depends on how long it takes for you to become whole again.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that $20 fee, but then there's interest and other penalties when you're late, but we could just say it's enormous.
Yeah.
It's typically higher than 400% for the payday.
It's below the median rate, that's for sure.
You know, I mean, Marnix runs a not-for-profit credit union. He charges a bounce check fee like everybody charges a bounce check fee. It's lower than the average, but still high. I don't know what to say about that, but I do think, as long as we're talking about Marnix, that this credit union he started, you know, dating back to the 1980s, they're a subprime mortgage lender. I mean, I hasten to add, given the association people have, that he's a different kind of subprime mortgage lender and started charging 4 or 5 or 6 or 7% above the conventional rate. He charges 1% above. He doesn't, you know, his loans didn't have huge upfront fees. You know, he made sure that you could pay it back, that if you make $25,000 a year, that you're buying a house for $50,000, let's say, rather than a $300,000 house that you're never going to be able to afford. But, you know, this credit union is specifically for those of modest means. You know, about half his customers are single moms. About half the people who bought homes using loans through him are people of color. He's making loans in rural communities, people who live in trailers that could move into a modest-sized house and have, as he would put it, you know, bricks-and-mortar savings account, a home. He is doing a lot of good. I mean, thousands and thousands of North Carolinians are living in a home who wouldn't otherwise. And the reason he created the Center for Responsible Lending in 2002 is he saw that while he was working hard to put people in homes, you had these other subprime mortgage lenders working hard to refinance people in loans they couldn't afford, expensive, expensive loans with huge rates of 10, 15, 20% interest. And, of course, people were losing their homes because of that. The payday lenders, he saw it all of a piece, that why is it that people on the bottom were having to pay these exorbitant rates, horrifically high rates, for their money? Where his argument falls short is there are very few affordable alternatives for the working poor. In North Carolina, if you're a state employee or a teacher, you could get a payday loan. But those are people who have good jobs. There's pockets here and there of well-meaning efforts. San Francisco, some non-profit credit unions are offering a affordable payday loan. I can't remember the exact rate, but it's, you know, 20% or so annual interest rate. But that's rare. And so there's this huge gap between the stuff that those who are living on the bottom can afford and what exists, which are these very high rate. And so the FDIC, other institutions, are trying to pressure banks, encourage banks, I'm not sure what the right term would be right there, to start offering, you know, a reasonably priced alternative. But, you know, the banks are very slowly getting into this, and the few examples I can think of, they're hardly affordable. They're $10 per hundred rather than $15 per hundred, which is cheaper, but we're back to a 250% effective annual percentage rate.
Well, while we're on this dilemma, there is one interesting aspect of the book that There's one that comes to mind in response to this. Yeah, your book was all right, man. In the early 1990s, despite the Community Reinvestment Act, the Bank of America began closing down its branches in African-American neighborhoods and replacing them with off-brand banks that were offering subprimes. Now, also, you have a 1998 HUD study revealing that an upper-income African-American was twice as likely to hold a subprime mortgage as a lower-income white homeowner. 2005 and 2006, nearly half of all African Americans buying a house were in subprimes. numerous data. Why has this financial racism been allowed to flourish? Why can banks continue to justify these decisions as cost-cutting measures?
Yeah, that's a very good question, a very hard question. And it's not just B of A. I mean, you know, B of A closed their branches in certain communities, inner city communities, you know, poor communities, and replaced them with off-brand. But, you know, so did Nations Bank, which became B of A eventually, and so did Wells Fargo, and so did Citigroup, Citibank. And, you know, we could go on. You know, it's... The Community Reinvestment Act, which essentially says if you have borrowers in a community, you need to make loans in that community, hasn't exactly been a high priority.
Yeah.
You know, the Congress in 1994 deputized Alan Greenspan and the Fed to look after the subprime mortgage area. You know, Alan Greenspan's famously hands-off, you know, Ayn Rand libertarian who thinks the market should determine all this. So he would speak out occasionally against abusive lending that targeted the most vulnerable. He would speak out against the targeting of minorities. He just wouldn't do anything about it. You point out that, you know, the HUD study near the end of the Clinton administration. In fact, you point out that high income above 100,000 African Americans were twice as likely as low income whites.
Yeah.
Low income whites.
Yeah.
But you know, across the board, if you lived in the late 1990s in a majority black neighborhood, you were five times more likely to get a subprime loan. I don't know if I could answer that other than to say, first off, it was never a priority. And second off, there was this counterbalancing force where it's simply seen as a societal good to put more people into housing, for people to own their own house. And, you know, so while there was concern on one front about racial discrimination in lending, there was a much more powerful force. I mean, Bill Clinton talked about it. The second George Bush made home ownership a big plank of his first term. So there was all this pressure on banks and other lenders to make more and more and more loans. Unfortunately, there was no provision that said, by the way, we care about people being able to pay back the loans. I mean, to me, the subprime mortgage crisis came down to putting people into loans or allowing people to get into loans that they couldn't afford. It helps no one to give someone a loan on a house that they're not going to be able to keep up the payments on. That's not the American dream.
Yeah.
That's like a nightmare.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I really feel like we lost our way with this notion that every last person should buy a house. Like, credit's not always a panacea. You know, some people aren't prepared to handle the loan. You know, I know a lender in New Mexico is a good friend of mine, and they do this. They make loans to the working class. Well, anyone who signs up has to go through financial education. You know, from the basics of how to write a check to starting to put money aside every month to start getting good habits, he's got a remarkably low delinquency rate compared to the delinquency rate we're seeing for other lenders, especially lenders who are making loans to the working class. And so it's not just as simple as, like, let's get people into a home they own. It's like, well, you need to do a little bit of work first to help that along.
But back to this really remarkable divide in terms of race, were you able to get any answer from any person you talked to, any lender, any bank, any individual who is in the process of deciding who gets the subprimes and who gets the reasonable interest loans on this subject as to why African Americans do not get, basically, they get completely lowballed with this subprime
right,
nonsense?
Right. to answer the question, the banks ain't talking about this. It's, you know, it's off the record. I mean, not between us, but, you know, the best you'll get is maybe an off the record comment. But, you know, there's been plenty of evidence along the way. One of the frustrating things for me in researching this book is how many warnings there had been about a coming subprime fiasco, dating back to the early 1990s. And so there's been Senate hearings, there's been hearings in the House, there's been hearings in various state legislative bodies around the country, and occasionally we hear from salespeople for these subprime lenders. And, you know, what was your perfect customer? They would tell you, they would testify, someone with a lack of education, a lack of sophistication about financial matters. I remember the testimony from someone before the U.S. Senate that, you know, we were looking for old widows, preferably living on their, you know, their dead husband's Social Security or pension, who weren't good with money and they owed a lot of credit card debt. That's who we were targeting. Well, a lot of that is inner city. Yeah. It's not just inner city. You go to rural areas. But, you know, what I found in my research is that subprime mortgage lending began in the inner cities, the banks getting a taste for the kinds of profits they were making off subprime, then moved to the white working class communities in the cities, and then they moved to the aging first ring suburbs. And then, you know, we all know the rest of the story. By the 2000s, they're moving to middle class communities, more prosperous communities, all these people who want to buy $600,000 homes with a salary good enough to afford a $300,000 home. But it started in the inner city. And you correctly point out what I think is one of the great underreported aspects of the subprime fiasco. It's got a huge racial element. But with that said, the Fed and the Wall Street Journal, the two that jumped to mind, did studies that showed that half, if not more than half, the people who were put into subprime loans had credit score ratings good enough to get a conventional loan. One of the big culprits here is the yield spread premium. That's just a fancy way of saying the bribe, the money bonus that a lender gave to a mortgage broker to put somebody into a higher cost loan than they otherwise qualified for. And so what we had are the mortgage brokers. I thought you go to a mortgage broker, I thought the one thing they do for a living is they shop around for you and put you in the best loan they could find on your behalf. That was a very naive thought. You know, what a lot, of course not all, but what a lot of mortgage brokers did is they went for the best deal for them, even if it meant that the couple in front of them qualified for a mortgage that would cost 6.5% interest a year. They'd put them in a 9% a year loan, a 10% interest loan, because it meant more money for them, and a lot of money, by the way. Typically, it was about a 2% fee, this yield spread premium, and, you know, 2% of a $300,000 loan, that's an extra $6,000 fee. And so I would talk to people who felt they were the victim of a subprime loan. I'm thinking of a blind couple in Columbus, Ohio. Their home was worth $37,000, but they were refinanced four times, and the broker who did the deal racked up about $12,000 in fees. So they're paying an extra $12,000 in fees just for this guy on a $37,000 house. I mean, it really became an opportunity for those who didn't care about ethics to make a lot of money.
What, though, of the adjustable rate mortgage, which was the specialty of World Savings, a subsidiary of Golden West? They offered the customer the choice to pay a lower rate. You write that the Sandlers were not ensnaring people with teaser rates as low as 1% annually and then hitting borrowers with higher rates years later. You also write that the adjustable rate mortgage was a more humane product that insulated borrowers from payment shock.
Wait. I wrote that their argument, I believe, that their argument...
It said more... Okay. You may have intended that, but I read it as they offered a more humane... But I want to be clear on this. I mean, surely the Sandlers were ensnaring people who could not afford to pay the higher rate into this high-interest trap.
Right.
I mean, what specifically made world savings more humane, whether from your perspective or from what it turns out to be the Sandler's perspective.
Right. So, the Sandler, what really makes this question a real hot potato is that Herb and Marion Sandler, founders of a bank they sold for $2 billion, or they sold for a lot of money, but they collected about $2 billion themselves. They were the major funder of the Center for Responsible Lending.
And the other hot potato, yeah.
So, you know, the critics of the Center for Responsible Lending have pointed out, like, hey, wait a second, you know, your biggest funder was a subprime lender and a irresponsible subprime lender. And by the way, I don't doubt that this option arm, the option adjustable rate mortgage that gave you a choice. You could pay the full amount every month. You could choose some intermediaries, or you could even pay less than the interest, which is in the trade a negative amortization. Like, you own less of the house with each passing month rather than more of the house with each passing month. And, you know, it's their argument is like, well, you lose a job for a few months, you'll appreciate having to pay less money. The problem is that there were some people who were only paying the lesser amount and never were building up any equity. And I think that's problematic. People within the Center for Responsible Lending, off the record, would tell me they thought it was irresponsible. The point I was making is that the singling out of the Sandlers as a poster boy for the subprime mess, that's where I didn't understand it. One of the signal traits of the subprime mortgage disaster was making the loan and then immediately turning around and selling it to Wall Street, who would then slice dice and sell it to pension funds and, you know, municipalities around the world. The Sandlers kept their loans. They kept them in portfolio. So they weren't irresponsibly making loans because they knew that next month it wasn't their problem. So that struck me. And the point you made that, you know, as irresponsible as the option arms were, there were even more irresponsible products out there. The teaser rates, because that's deception to me.
Yeah. You know, so more humane by comparison, but not so humane in light of the fact that it was a really dicey subprime.
Right. Just to put it bluntly, they got caught up, just like a lot of lenders caught up, in the subprime craziness. And, you know, I'm not here to defend the Sandlers. It's just my old employer, the New York Times, put him in page one as one of the poster boys. The Saturday Night Live famously, you know, had a mock C-SPAN interview where they identified Herb and Marion Sandler, and it said under their name, you know, people who deserve to be shot.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is like, well, why are you singling them out? I would choose, you know, Angelo Mozilla over at Countrywide before I choose them. I would choose Ameriquest. I would choose Household Finance. I mean, there are all sorts of lenders that I thought were far more abusive. But, you know, we're splitting hairs at this point. I thought what they did was abusive.
Got it. One last question. Gary, Indiana is often held up as the poster boy city for complete impoverishment. Entire blocks decimated because U.S. Steel left that city. You visit a lot of areas in Ohio and various other towns, and we see the same kind of pure ravishing of a community where nobody lives there. Is it safe to say that subprime lenders, payday lenders, high interest lenders represent essentially the new Gary, Indiana for the 21st century?
Well, they certainly, the payday lenders, et cetera, see the Gary, Indiana's as a prime opportunity. I mean, some of the reason I wanted to write this book is I was just fascinated by this upside-down world in which people with little money in their pockets is good for business. There's an expression or a saying in the payday lending industry that I absolutely love, that a banker is looking for 100 customers worth at least $1 million. The payday lender is looking for 1 million customers worth less than $100. And so Dayton, Ohio, where I spent some time, they've had two GM plants and a Delco plant closed down. There's a lot more people with $100 in their pocket who are desperate for short-term loans, whether through a pawnbroker or a payday lender, the instant tax refunds we talked about. So, yeah, I would say Gary, Indiana is just spelling the future as we see more and more foreclosures and more communities that in appearances look like a ravaged Gary, Indiana community.
You mentioned like Bernanke is sort of an improvement on Greenspan, but not by much. Is it a problem that's even possible to solve?
I don't know if Ben Bernanke can solve the problem of Gary, Indiana. Bernanke made a lot of fundamental changes, positive changes, in 2007 and 2008 that Alan Greenspan never made. So, you know, is he a godsend from a consumer rights point of view? No, but he's head and shoulders above Alan Greenspan in, you know, cracking down on many of the abuses that were at the bottom of the subprime mortgage lending. But, you know, I don't see Ben Bernanke doing anything about payday lenders, and I don't think that's his job. There's a proposal moving through Congress right now for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which, by the way, one version of it would be living under Ben Bernanke in the Fed. But I see an agency like that taking on this whole issue of check cashing. Like, a third of the states in this country have no cap on the fees that a check casher can charge for cashing a check. I see them taking on some of the issues we've raised during this conversation of maybe we should cap the number of payday loans a person could have at one time or can take out in a year. So I'm thinking that agency is a place where a lot of the reform could take place rather than, you know, the chairman of the Fed.
Okay. Well, Gary, this has been a very interesting conversation. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
Great, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Okay.
Now, once I lived the life of a millionaire, I was spending plenty of money and I didn't bid more care. I was taking my boyfriend out for a good time, buying them champagne, whiskey, and sometime wine. But somehow or another...